Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. This is KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. And for our virtual listeners, we hope your computer is locked on our website, kptz.org. Our website's more than a way to listen to today's show. For example, you can find the biographies of all hosts and DJs. You can look up calendar listings to find out what's happening around town. You can even sample some of our earlier shows. In fact, much of the original programming on KPTZ is currently available as podcasts. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? The Wooden Boat Festival brought tons of tourists, of course, but who's in the army of volunteers who do everything from controlling boat traffic to parking cars? I bet they're mostly locals, devoted to our maritime heritage. And who are the young athletes who've been honing their skills down at the parade ground at Fort Worden? Perhaps the next generation of business owners and city council members are out there today. Who drives taxis around town? They say taxi drivers are like hairstylists. They know a lot of secrets. Jefferson County is full of all sorts of fascinating characters. This show, Our Town, tries to profile a few of the singular personalities who live here. But the show's only a half hour long, which is definitely not long enough to do justice to some of our fellow citizens. So it's a synopsis. We try to get our guests to talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is Piper Dunlap, an acupuncturist and herbalist with offices on Lawrence Street. I'm a little curious. Piper is a relatively unusual name. Is that a nickname or a real name? What is it?
It's my middle name.
Okay.
My parents very generously gave me four names, so I'm only on the second one now. I guess I've got a couple more to go.
Okay, what's the full four?
The full four, it's Timothy, Piper, Cameron, Dunlap.
Whoa, you've got a selection there.
So Piper was the champagne that my parents drank to celebrate my arrival.
Well, yeah, it's a cool name. I was just wondering. So Piper, I always like to start at the beginning. Are you a local boy born and bred in Jefferson County?
No, I've been here since 2003. I was born in Miami, Florida, though I only lived there for about 6 weeks before moving to Germany.
And how long did your family stay there?
We were there for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom is from Germany.
Did you pick up any German?
Yeah, I did. Probably more later on when I would go back to Germany during the summer. My folks got us out of the nest and shipped us off to grandma's house in Germany.
Yeah.
So most of my Germany memories were from later on.
Okay. So you moved back to the States after Germany?
We moved back to my father's hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. We lived there for a couple of years, and then we moved around a lot on the East Coast following my dad's job.
Okay. And where did you end up, or did you just keep moving around?
We lived in Connecticut and Washington, D.C., North Carolina. My father was an urban renewal administrator, and that took him from city to city. And eventually, he got sick of that job. He didn't really enjoy that work that much, and he wanted to do something else. And one of his exit strategies, once he'd climbed that ladder and ended up in Washington, D.C., was to go somewhere else, exotic, somewhere different, and start something completely different. We ended up moving to St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, and my parents started a small guest house, an inn, sort of a European-style inn in the tropics.
Wow. So how old were you at that point?
I was seven.
You were seven, okay.
Yeah.
And did you stay there for your teenage years?
I did, yeah. I stayed there for 11 years.
Okay.
So my formative years.
I'm always
years.
Curious about the high school experience because kids label each other. You're aware of what they're saying where you are. You're a nerd or you're a jock or whatever. You might not agree with it, but you sort of get the idea of what's going on. What did people think of you at that stage in your life?
Well, it was a radical change moving from suburban Washington, D.C. down to the Caribbean. And right. One of the most obvious features of that move was that when I arrived there, I was suddenly in the minority.
Right.
So I was the only white kid in my class, so I stood out that way.
Yeah.
And although our teachers and the principal were all white and they were all missionaries, because the school I went to was a parochial school, it offered a better education. It was a very strict situation.
So your parents had this inn. Was it big or small or medium? How
it
many guests?
It had 24 rooms once when it was at its largest, so pretty
well,
small.
That's, I don't know, that's reasonable size.
Yeah.
But work like that is very all-consuming, I would think.
They both worked very hard.
Aha. Uh-huh. And did you help out? Were you having jobs around the inn?
When I was 9, I was in charge of the swimming pool, so I did all of the chemicals and cleaned the filter and skimmed the leaves. That was my main job. We all worked there. I was a bartender at age 10 or 11. I knew how to make all of the house specialties, which were complicated.
I'm sure that
rum drinks, you know. With,
today, that might be frowned on.
Yeah.
Then I don't think anyone really cared.
It was a different era.
Yeah, I would think so. So when you were a teenager, did you have your head, you know, that you were going to be X when you so-called grew up? Or were you just drifting? What?
I still don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up.
Yes, I know the feeling. But what did you do when you first got out of high school?
When I first got out of high school, I was a year younger than everyone else. And I realized that I wasn't really quite ready to go to college. So I took a year deferment. I was accepted at college and I took a year off. That was fine with them. And so I went and worked. I went back to the Virgin Islands and I worked as a lobster fisherman, and I worked in a restaurant. It was a great year. I did a lot of growing up during that year, I'd say.
Okay, and did you then make up your mind you were gonna X?
I went to college and I studied biology. I had a sort of a vague idea that I wanted to do science or maybe medicine. Mm-hmm. So back then I already had that idea of helping people working in healthcare. I had two cousins who were both doctors, and mm-hmm. they saw my inclinations at school and my grades, and they were convinced that I should be a doctor. And I looked up to them, so I kind of followed that path for a while. But I didn't end up becoming a doctor.
Yes and no.
Yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you dropped out? Is that what happened? Or what?
I saw my college time going by, and I still felt like I was an unformed blob. And I wanted to experience the world some more. So I got a job on a school ship, which was academic, still educational, but more exciting. I got to mm-hmm. go sailing, which I have always loved my whole life.
Was this out of St. Thomas?
This was out of Boston. It was through Harvard University, and it was a tall ship, a 150-foot barkentine called Regina Maris, and it was used as a platform for science, marine mammals science, oceanography, marine biology, even volcanology. And then it took students on board. So the students would help the scientists do the science, and they got an education and credits through Harvard. We went all over the Caribbean, through the Panama Canal. We went down to the Galapagos Islands.
Wow.
With some scientists on board. Just a fabulous trip there.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. How long did you do that?
I did that for just over a year.
And then?
And then I realized the clock was ticking, and if I wanted to preserve some of my study habits and get on with it and finish college, I had better do it soon. So when I came back, I applied to schools, and I ended up going to UC Berkeley. That's where I got my undergraduate degree.
In what?
In comparative literature.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you became a university professor?
Well, that is the career track with Comp Lit. I just ran the other way. I mean, my teachers all expected me to go to graduate school, and they were very surprised when I said I wasn't going to do that. So I took a path of least resistance. I was, at that point, pretty good at things maritime. I knew celestial navigation. I had my captain's license from having worked on Regina Maris, and I ended up going to work for a tour boat company in San Francisco Bay. I worked my way up through that hierarchy, and I was there for 13 years running tour boats. I became a captain, and so I took people out under the Golden Gate Bridge and down to Jack London Square.
How big were these boats?
The largest boat that I ran was the California Hornblower, and she was 185 feet. She carried 1,000 passengers.
Wow.
We didn't always have 1,000 people on board. Often we had half that number. But on busy nights like New Year's Eve or opening day on the bay, we were usually maxed out at 950 passengers and 50 crew. And so I had 50 people working for me on that ship and a lot of guests.
That's a lot. Now, these weren't overnight excursions. These were just day or evening.
The proverbial three-hour cruise.
Okay. During the years you were doing it, were there any accidents, any serious accidents? It
seems inevitable. You process a lot of tourists over a busy weekend, thousands, in fact, and so it's bound to happen.
But you didn't have anything like run ashore or something like that?
I ran aground once. We would do remote tours where we would have to take the ships into places where we hadn't been before to pick up guests because, of course, the salespeople want to promise the world to our guests, and so they come up with these wild plans about picking people up in remote locations. So those were challenging and fun. I love that part of it, the boat handling and the, you know, sort of the adventurous part of moving boats around.
I've always sort of wondered this. People who make their livelihood on the water in their off time, do they ever go out on the water sailing a personal vessel or anything, or is it you do it 8 or 10 hours a day and that's it?
Well, I worked with a lot of people who were on the water only for their work. Then when they went home, they did things, terrestrial things.
Grew tomatoes.
Yeah. I was kind of an extremist. I loved the water. My dad built me my first boat when I was 7, when we first moved to the Virgin Islands. And that was such a revelation that I could have this little craft, my own little spaceship, say, and take off on it and have adventures. And that really stuck. And I still do that to this day. So when I was working on the water, in my free time, I went right out on that same water, but on smaller craft, usually windsurfers or small sailboats.
Yeah. You're right. You really went for it. Then you said you did it for 13 years. Did something dramatic happen?
I got sort of tired of it. I met my wife, and we decided to go take a little piece of our retirement sort of in midlife. Mm-hmm. So we bought a sailboat and we moved aboard and gave up our apartment in San Francisco and were able to save a lot of money. We had 2 incomes, no kids, saved enough money to go cruising. We both quit our jobs and we left and we went sailing down to Mexico, sailed around for about a year in the Sea of Cortez. And then we came back and our jobs happened to be waiting there for us. They hired us back, so we worked some more. That's for another couple of years, living on our boat, saved more money, and then we took off on a more ambitious cruise and sailed down through Central America, Mexico, Central America, the Panama Canal, and up through the Western Caribbean.
I take it she's as much of a sailing nut as you are.
It's interesting because this morning we were sitting in bed reading, and she was reading a description of a sailboat that we have been talking about that might be in our future. In the meantime, we've had 2 children and raised them here in Port Townsend, and I would say my wife has not been out sailing very much during that time. We have a much smaller boat, and the water's colder here, so I think our cruise through the warm climes of Central America and the Caribbean spoiled her, and so here.
Okay. Yeah. You're listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. Our Town profiles some of the unique personalities who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest, Piper Dunlap, an acupuncturist here in Port Townsend. We've been talking about his life growing up in St. Thomas, being something of a vagabond sailor for quite a while, working on tall ships, on research vessels. And then he was a captain of tour boats in San Francisco. He and his wife ultimately took all sorts of sailing adventures. He's just about to tell me how they decided to give up the sailing life and end up, of all places, in Port Townsend. So that's a fur piece from being out in Central America on a boat. So tell me what happened.
We spent the better part of 2 years cruising, and we were sailing around down in Central America and the Caribbean. We were looking for a place to live, to go and find some alternative lifestyle down there. And we didn't really find it. We discovered that we have very successfully, as a culture, exported Western popular culture everywhere. And we had a naive idea that we could go find an idyllic place to live, possibly to raise some kids. And it didn't really happen in that time. And we began to suspect that it might not happen. Mm-hmm. And we met a lot of people down there who were living, mm-hmm. but basically as guests in other countries. It seemed like the expats that we met in Costa Rica, Guatemala, Panama, Belize, their society was among themselves and they were separate from the primary culture there. And we didn't want to do that. So we decided to come home and make a go of it back here in the States. And we weren't in any rush. We still had some funds and we were having a fabulous time. We also decided at that point that if we were going to come home, that maybe we would start a family. That conversation happened in the San Blas Islands of Panama, which is just a fabulous, beautiful, pristine place. And suddenly we were pregnant. So that's what brought us back, is the urgency of being pregnant. And
finding
being
a nest.
That's right. When we finally got back to the States, my wife was quite pregnant. So our daughter was born in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then the reality of having to provide for a family, things were changing rapidly. And at that point, I had had two very positive experiences with acupuncture and Chinese medicine.
As a patient?
As a patient, okay. Yes. It really helped me a lot with some chronic pain. Happened once in San Francisco and then again in Panama. We were down there and miraculously an acupuncture student showed up on the bus in this remote place where we were. And she gave me several treatments and helped me with pain. And it really made an impression on me. And the idea of going to medical school was out of the question at that point. I was too old. Mm-hmm. But I could study Chinese medicine and do something else, something different, outside of the Western biomedical world to help people and offer something that had really helped me a lot. So that's what I did. I applied to several Chinese medicine schools.
And so you didn't have a friend or a mentor who was in one or guided you to a particular school?
No, it was based on my experiences as a patient.
Okay.
I researched schools and realized that California was a good place to go to school because Chinese medicine was very well established in California, more so than
anywhere. So where did you end up going?
So I went to school in Santa Barbara. I went to the Santa Barbara College of Oriental Medicine, and it was a three-year program. It was more like a four-year program crammed into 3 years. Most of my classmates took 4 years to do it, and there were five or six of us who did it in 3 years.
So what are some of the classes?
Well, we learned some Western medicine. Some of the prerequisites are the same prerequisites that you would have for nursing or anything in Western medicine. Right. Anatomy, physiology. I loved those classes. They were some of my favorites.
Yeah.
Then you are introduced to the strange, wonderful world of Chinese medicine, which is radically different than Western medicine. The classes are about the acupuncture, points location, channel theory, and then also herbology, and then some other modalities like...
Okay, you just said that Chinese medicine is radically different than Western medicine. Could you explain that a little bit? I know you can't.
Yeah, that's a big question.
90 seconds.
Yeah, I'll give you my impressions. So my early impressions when I started studying Chinese medicine, I was somewhat naive. I thought that they had a lot of common ground, but it turns out that they are very different. For example, I was the guy in the classroom who raised his hand and asked, "Wait a minute, I don't understand. Is it this or is it that?" And my professor would say something like, "Yes, grasshopper." And it was infuriating. And it took me a while to accept the fact that I was such a Western guy and that I would have to change that in order to practice Chinese medicine. If you think about the languages, they are radically different, of course, and even the way we write the languages. So I feel like one of the clues about how different the two medicines are lies in the fact that the languages and the way we write the languages are radically different. So in the West, we have a phonetic alphabet that has symbols which represent sounds, mm-hmm. and they are fairly abstract and not nature-based. But the Chinese alphabet is an alphabet of characters. So each character is a picture or a painting, an image of something that comes from nature or something that man has made within the realm of nature. So the medicine is a reflection of the relationship that we have with the world around us. And the Chinese relationship is within the context of the natural world, and the medicine is informed that way. So let's take a condition, let's say reflux. A lot of people have had reflux or had indigestion,
right.
GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder,
right.
GERD. So that's a Western diagnosis.
Right.
And, you know, it's uncomfortable. Maybe there's some burping involved and it's not good for your esophagus and can lead to complications. That's a Western diagnosis. In Chinese medicine, five people with those symptoms, they would all be considered having GERD, could come into a Chinese office at different times, and each one of them might have a different diagnosis. So their symptoms are the same symptoms as the GERD patient in the West, but the practitioner, the doctor, notices some other things from asking questions, a different set of questions than a Western doctor would ask, and notices that those five people are fundamentally different, and they all have some similar symptoms, but they have other things that are different about them. And then the Chinese doctor comes up with five different diagnoses. They all have GERD, but they're all diagnosed somewhat differently and treated differently. So the diagnosis process and the treatment process are very different, which makes Chinese medicine brilliant in the Western context because it's different and it looks at a patient from a different angle, we could say.
It sounds almost more individualistic.
I would say that's accurate. It takes more time in the clinic to come up with those subtle differences.
Mm-hmm.
So say, I'll just give you I'll use some of the terminology of those diagnoses.
Right.
So that GERD person, or those five GERD patients might have stomach fire, and another one might have wood overacting on earth, or another way to say that would be liver, gallbladder, harassing or overacting on the spleen stomach. And then another one might have yin deficiency of the stomach, and on and on. So those are, you notice that they sound sort of like, more like a weather report than than a diagnosis.
Right.
Damp heat harassing the gallbladder.
And the treatment for these would be by way of needles on different areas of the body?
That would be the acupuncture treatment.
Right.
So the Chinese practitioner comes up with a diagnosis and then treats according to that pattern or syndrome, we call it. And they would get those three patients with three different Chinese diagnoses for GERD patients would get somewhat different acupuncture treatments, and then also would probably take herbs and be advised about diet.
Right.
All of those.
And in terms of the herbs, do you actually mix them up or do you prescribe them and they get them somewhere else?
In China and in big cities in the West, you would go to an herbal pharmacy somewhere else and get them. In Port Townsend, we're not big enough to support an independent Chinese herbal pharmacy.
Yeah, I've never noticed one.
So the acupuncturists in Port Townsend, some of them are herbalists also, and some aren't. But those of us who do prescribe herbs, we have our own pharmacies. In my case, I have bulk herbs, which is what you would get in China. You would go to a pharmacy and get the herbs themselves. They, one of those GERD patients, I come up with a formula for that, and I mix those herbs up, and that patient gets several bags of herbs and goes home and does some work at home by cooking those herbs, and then they drink the herbs every day. And then when they're done with that bag of herbs, they cook up another bag of herbs, and the house smells very exotic for a few hours. Some people love that. I would say 10 to 15% of my herb patients like doing it the old-fashioned way, and then most people would rather take it in a pill.
Yeah. I can see that. We're sort of used to that in the Western culture.
And in China, they also like taking pills.
Yeah. You said early on that as a patient, you had an extremely good reaction to acupuncture. Is that typical, or how does it shake out across the boards?
Right. I would say I had an extremely good response. I mean, miraculous. If there were an acupuncture genie and I had three wishes, one of my wishes would be that all of my patients had as miraculously good results as I had. not everybody has that kind of amazing response. Most people, I would say 95% of my patients have good response, but sometimes it takes a few treatments. For me, the first treatment I had took 20 minutes of having the needles in, and I was pain-free for the first time in a year, which really gets your attention.
It would. You know, we're almost out of time here. The producer's tearing his hair, but I just have one or two more things I want to ask.
Okay.
And one is this. You're here in Port Townsend. Your patients, are they different ages? Do you see any trends? I mean, what kind of people?
Well, I see a cross-section of our community, and I would say there are some trends. My patient demographic is aging, as am I.
It's a
natural progression. Although I would say recently, in the last couple of years, I see more and more younger people. When I first started practicing here back in 2003, I had two young children, and my social world revolved around parents with young children.
Right.
Naturally, I met those people, and I had more young patients back then when my children were young. And my children are older now, and so that's not as much of an influence, I suppose. But it's, you know, Port Townsend is a small town, and I have to be a generalist as a practitioner. So I see a little bit of everything, and yeah.
What about the attitude of Western doctors towards Chinese medicine? Has that shifted in the past few years?
I would say it has shifted gradually and consistently over the last 15, 16 years. Since I've been here in practice, I've seen it change. When I first arrived, my patients' other doctors, right, their primary care providers, would say something like, that's voodoo, or that doesn't work. Some of them back then would say, well, you know, if that makes you feel better, okay, you go ahead and do that. Mm-hmm. But now there are quite a few doctors who send me patients. And I think it's just slowly become more clear to the Western biomedical world that acupuncture and Chinese medicine is effective.
Okay. I just want to ask one last thing before I get dragged out of here kicking and screaming, which is this. Are there some cases where you, as an acupuncturist and herbalist, would recommend to X person, no, you need to see a Western doctor about that?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, that is, we learn that in school. You know, we have to be able to refer out. If you see a dangerously high blood pressure or something that looks like cancer, then we refer. And most people already have a Western doctor, so it's easy. You just say, you should go make an appointment with your doctor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. It zipped by. I want to thank John, the man in the glass booth, the editor and producer of Our Town. He's the one who will smooth out all of our mumbles and grumbles. He will make me and you sound so much better than we actually do. I also want to thank all the great people who work here at KPTZ. We're a community radio station. Everyone is a volunteer. I want to thank you, the listener. We need you to listen. We need you to contribute, too. We're trying to raise money to move to new headquarters. Keep those donations coming in, folks. I'm signing off for today. Thank you, Piper Dunlap, acupuncturist here in Port Townsend. Keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.